negative white stereotypes with death metal music blaring. Another example of auditory cueing explains a thoroughly poignant anecdote told by my Stanford colleague, Claude Steele, who has done seminal research on stereotyping. Steele recounts how an African-American male grad student of his, knowing the stereotypes that a young black man evokes on the genteel streets of Palo Alto, whistled Vivaldi when walking home at night, hoping to evoke instead, "Hey, that's not Snoop Dogg, that's a dead white male composer. Exhale." No discussion of subliminal sensory cueing is complete without considering olfaction, a subject marketing people have salivated over since we were projected to watch Smell-O-Vision someday. The human olfactory system is atrophied. Roughly 40% of a rat's brain is devoted to olfactory processing versus 3% in us. Nonetheless, we still have unconscious olfactory lives, and as in rodents, our olfactory system sends more direct projections to the limbic system than other sensory systems. As noted, rodent pheromones carry information about sex, age, reproductive status, health, and genetic makeup, and they alter physiology and behavior. Similar, if milder, versions of the same are reported in some, but not all, studies of humans, ranging from the Wellesley effect, discussed in the introduction, to heterosexual women preferring the smell of high testosterone men. Importantly, pheromones signal fear. In one study, researchers got armpit swabs from volunteers under two conditions: either after contentedly sweating during a comfortable run, or after sweating in terror during their first tandem skydive. Note, in tandem skydives, you're yoked to the instructor who does the physical work, so if you're sweating, it's from panic, not physical effort. Subjects sniffed each type of sweat and couldn't consciously distinguish between them. However, sniffing terrified sweat, but not contented sweat, caused amygdaloid activation, a bigger startle response, improved detection of subliminal angry faces, and increased odds of interpreting an ambiguous face as looking fearful. If people around you smell scared, your brain tilts toward concluding that you are too. Finally, non-pheromonal odors influence us as well. As we'll see in Chapter 12, if people sit in a room with smelly garbage, they become more conservative about social issues, e.g. gay marriage, without changing their opinions about, say, foreign policy or economics. Interoceptive information. In addition to information about the outside world, our brains constantly receive interoceptive information about the body's internal state. You feel hungry. Your back aches. Your gassy intestine twinges. Your big toe itches. And such interoceptive information influences our behavior as well. This brings us to the time-honored James Lang theory, named for William James, a grand mufti in the history of psychology, and an obscure Danish physician, Carl Lang. In the 1880s, they independently concocted the same screwy idea. How do your feelings and your body's automatic, i.e. autonomic, function interact? It seems obvious. A lion chases you, you feel terrified, and thus your heart speeds up. James and Lang suggested the opposite. You subliminally note the lion, speeding up your heart, then your conscious brain gets this interoceptive information concluding, "Wow, my heart is racing, I must be terrified." In other words, you decide what you feel based on signals from your body. There's support for the idea. Three of my favorites are that A, forcing depressed people to smile makes them feel better; B, instructing people to take on a more dominant posture makes them feel more so, lowers stress hormone levels; and C, muscle relaxants decrease anxiety. Things are still awful, but if my muscles are so relaxed that I'm dribbling out of this chair, things must be improving. Nonetheless, a strict version of James Lang doesn't work because of the issue of specificity. Hearts race for varying reasons. So how does your brain decide if it's reacting to a lion or an exciting come-hither look? Moreover, many autonomic responses are too slow to precede conscious awareness of an emotion. Nonetheless, interoceptive information influences, if not determines, our emotions. Some brain regions with starring roles in processing social emotions, the PFC, insular cortex, anterior cingulate cortex, and amygdala, receive lots of interoceptive information. This helps explain a reliable trigger of aggression, namely pain, which activates most of those regions. As a repeating theme, pain does not cause aggression. It amplifies pre-existing tendencies toward aggression. In other words, pain makes aggressive people more aggressive, while doing the opposite to unaggressive individuals. Interoceptive information can alter behavior more subtly than in the pain-aggression link. One example concerns how much the frontal cortex has to do with willpower, harking back to material covered in the last chapter. Various studies, predominantly by Roy Baumeister of Florida State University, show that when the frontal cortex labors hard on some cognitive task, immediately afterward, individuals are more aggressive and less empathic, charitable, and honest. Metaphorically, the frontal cortex says, "Screw it, I'm tired and don't feel like thinking about my fellow human." This seems related to the metabolic costs of the frontal cortex doing the harder thing. During frontally demanding tasks, blood glucose levels drop, and frontal function improves if subjects are given a sugary drink, with control subjects consuming a drink with a non-nutritive sugar substitute. Moreover, when people are hungry, they become less charitable and more aggressive, e.g., choosing more severe punishment for an opponent in a game. There's debate as to whether the decline in frontal regulation in these circumstances represents impaired capacity for self-control or impaired motivation for it. But either way, over the course of seconds to minutes, the amount of energy reaching the brain and the amount of energy the frontal cortex needs have something to do with whether the harder, more correct thing happens. Thus, sensory information streaming toward your brain from both the outside world and your body can rapidly, powerfully, and automatically alter behavior. In the minutes before our prototypical behavior occurs, more complex stimuli influence us as well. Unconscious language effects. Words have power. They can save, cure, uplift, devastate, deflate, and kill. And unconscious priming with words influences pro- and anti-social behaviors. One of my favorite examples concerns the prisoner's dilemma, the economic game where participants decide whether to cooperate or compete at various junctures. And behavior is altered by situational labels. Call the game the Wall Street game, and people become less cooperative. Calling it the community game does the opposite. Similarly, have subjects read seemingly random word lists before playing. Embedding warm, fuzzy, pro-social words in the list, help, harmony, fair, mutual, fosters cooperation, while words like rank, power, fierce, and inconsiderate foster the opposite. Mind you, this isn't subjects reading either Christ's Sermon on the Mount or Ayn Rand, just an innocuous string of words. Words unconsciously shift thoughts and feelings. One person's terrorist is another's freedom fighter. Politicians jockey to commandeer family values, and somehow you can't favor both choice and life. Footnote. One recent study demonstrates a pointed version of this. Describing someone as African American evokes associations with higher levels of education and income than does describing them as black. There are more examples. In Nobel Prize-winning research, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky famously showed word framing altering decision-making. Subjects decide whether to administer a hypothetical drug. If they're told the drug has a 95% survival rate, people, including doctors, are more likely to approve it than when told the drug has a 5% death rate. Footnote. A recent study shows life and death consequences of linguistic cueing. For or the same storm intensity, hurricanes arbitrarily given female names kill more people than do those with male names. Names alternate between the two genders. Why? People unconsciously take male-named hurricanes more seriously and are more likely to comply with evacuation orders. And this despite both male and female names being selected for their innocuousness. This isn't comparing Hurricane Mary Poppins with Hurricane Vlad the Impaler. Embed rude or aggressive versus considerate or polite in word strings, and subjects interrupt people more immediately afterward. Subjects primed with loyalty versus equality become more biased toward their team in economic games. Verbal primes also impact moral decision-making. As every trial lawyer knows, juries decide differently depending on how colorfully you describe someone's act. Neuroimaging studies show that more colorful wording engages the anterior cingulate more. Moreover, people judge moral transgressions more harshly when they are described as wrong or inappropriate versus forbidden or blameworthy. Even subtler types of unconscious cueing. In the minutes before a behavior is triggered, subtler things than sights and smells, gas pain, and choice of words unconsciously influence us. In one study, subjects filling out a questionnaire expressed stronger egalitarian principles if there was an American flag in the room. In a study of spectators at English football matches, a researcher planted in the crowd slips, seemingly injuring his ankle. Does anyone help him? If the plant wore the home team's sweatshirt, he received more help than when he wore a neutral sweatshirt or one of the opposing team. Another study involved a subtle group membership manipulation. For a number of days, pairs of conservatively dressed Hispanics stood at train stations during rush hour in predominantly white Boston suburbs, conversing quietly in Spanish. The consequence? White commuters expressed more negative, exclusionary attitudes toward Hispanic, but not other, immigrants. Cueing about group membership is complicated by people belonging to multiple groups. Consider a famous study of Asian American women who took a math test. Everyone knows that women are worse at math than men. We'll see in Chapter 9 how that's not really so. And Asian Americans are better at it than other Americans. Subjects primed beforehand to think about their racial identity performed better than did those primed to think about their gender. Another realm of rapid group influences on behavior is usually known incorrectly. This is the bystander effect, aka the Genovese syndrome. This refers to the notorious 1964 case of Kitty Genovese, the New Yorker who was raped and stabbed to death over the course of an hour outside an apartment building while 38 people heard her shrieks for help and didn't bother calling the police. Despite that being reported by the New York Times and the collective indifference becoming emblematic of all that's wrong with people, the facts differed. The number was less than 38. No one witnessed the entire event. Apartment windows were closed on that winter's night, and most assumed they were hearing the muffled sounds of a lover's quarrel. The mythic elements of the Genovese case prompt the quasi-myth that in an emergency requiring brave intervention, the more people present, the less likely anyone is to help. There's a lot of people here, someone else will step forward. The bystander effect does occur in non-dangerous situations, where the price of stepping forward is inconvenience. However, in dangerous situations, the more people present, the more likely individuals are to step forward. Why? Perhaps elements of reputation, where a larger crowd equals more witnesses to one's heroics. Another rapid social context effect shows men in some of their lamest moments. Specifically, when women are present, or when men are prompted to think about women, they become more risk-taking, show steeper temporal discounting and economic decisions, and spend more on luxury items, but not on mundane expenses. Moreover, the allure of the opposite sex makes men more aggressive. For example, more likely in a competitive game to punish the opposing guy with loud blasts of noise. Crucially, this is not inevitable. In circumstances where status is achieved through pro-social routes, the presence of women makes men more pro-social. As summarized in the title of one paper demonstrating this, this seems a case of male generosity as a mating signal. We'll return to this theme in the next chapter. Thus, our social environment unconsciously shapes our behavior over the course of minutes, as does our physical environment. Now we come to the broken window theory of crime of James Q. Wilson and George Kelling. They proposed that small signs of urban disarray, litter, graffiti, broken windows, public drunkenness, form a slippery slope leading to larger signs of disarray, leading to increased crime. Why? Because litter and graffiti as the norm mean people don't care or are powerless to do anything, constituting an invitation to litter or worse. Broken window thinking shaped Rudy Giuliani's mayoralty in the 1990s, when New York was turning into a Hieronymus Bosch painting. Police Commissioner William Bratton instituted a zero-tolerance policy toward minor infractions, targeting subway fare evaders, graffiti artists, vandals, beggars, and the city's maddening infestation of squeegee men, which was followed by a steep drop in rates of serious crime. Similar results occurred elsewhere. In Lowell, Massachusetts, zero-tolerance measures were experimentally applied in only one part of the city. Serious crime dropped only in that area. Critics questioned whether the benefits of broken window policing were inflated, given that the approach was tested when crime was already declining throughout the United States. In other words, in contrast to the commendable Lowell examples, studies often lacked control groups. In a test of the theory, Kees Keijzer of the University of Groningen in the Netherlands asked whether cues of one type of norm violation made people prone to violating other norms. When bicycles were chained to a fence, despite a sign forbidding it, people were more likely to take a shortcut through a gap in the fence, despite a sign forbidding it. People littered more when walls were graffitied. People were more likely to steal a 5-euro note when litter was strewn around. These were big effects, with doubling rates of crummy behaviors. A norm violation increasing the odds of that same norm being violated is a conscious process. But when the sound of fireworks makes someone more likely to litter, more unconscious processes are at work. A wonderfully complicating piece of the story. We've now seen how sensory and interoceptive information influence the brain to produce a behavior within seconds to minutes. But as a complication, the brain can alter the sensitivity of those sensory modalities, making some stimuli more influential. As an obvious one, dogs prick up their ears when they're alert. The brain has stimulated ear muscles in a way that enables the ear to more easily detect sounds, which then influences the brain. During acute stress, all of our sensory systems become more sensitive. More selectively, if you're hungry, you become more sensitive to the smell of food. How does something like this work? A priori, it seems as if all sensory roads lead to the brain. But the brain also sends neuronal projections to sensory organs. For example, low blood sugar might activate particular hypothalamic neurons. These in turn project to and stimulate receptor neurons in the nose that respond to food smells. The stimulation isn't enough to give those receptor neurons action potentials, but it now takes fewer food odorant molecules to trigger one. Something along these lines explains how the brain alters the selective sensitivity of sensory systems. This certainly applies to the behaviors that fill this book. Recall how eyes carry lots of information about emotional state. It turns out that the brain biases us toward preferentially looking at eyes. This was shown by Damasio, studying a patient with Wernicke-Witte disease, which selectively destroys the amygdala. As expected, she was poor at accurately detecting fearful faces. But in addition, while control subjects spent about half their face-gazing time looking at eyes, she spent half that. When instructed to focus on the eyes, she improved at recognizing fearful expressions. Thus, not only does the amygdala detect fearful faces, but it also biases us toward obtaining information about fearful faces. Psychopaths are typically poor at recognizing fearful expressions, though they accurately recognize other types. They also look less at eyes than normal and improve at fear recognition when directed to focus on eyes. This makes sense given the amygdaloid abnormalities in psychopaths noted in Chapter 2. Now an example foreshadowing Chapter 9's focus on culture. Show subjects a picture of an object embedded in a complex background. Within seconds, people from collectivist cultures, e.g. China, tend to look more at and remember better the surrounding contextual information, while people from individualistic cultures, e.g. the United States, do the same with the focal object. Instruct subjects to focus on the domain that their culture doesn't gravitate toward, and there's frontal cortical activation. This is a difficult perceptual task. Thus, culture literally shapes how and where you look at the world. Footnote. As an important point, this is indeed a case of acculturation rather than a reflection of populational genetic differences. East Asian Americans show the typical American pattern. Conclusions. No brain operates in a vacuum, and over the course of seconds to minutes, the wealth of information streaming into the brain influences the likelihood of pro- or antisocial acts. As we've seen, pertinent information ranges from something as simple and unidimensional as shirt color to things as complex and subtle as cues about ideology. Moreover, the brain also constantly receives interoceptive information. And most important, much of these varied types of information is subliminal. Ultimately, the most important point of this chapter is that in the moments just before we decide upon some of our most consequential acts, we are less rational and autonomous decision makers than we like to think. Chapter 4. Hours to days before. We now take the next step back in our chronology, considering events from hours to days before a behavior occurs. To do so, we enter the realm of hormones. What are the effects of hormones on the brain and sensory systems that filled the last two chapters? How do hormones influence our best and worst behaviors? While this chapter examines various hormones, the most attention is paid to one inextricably tied to aggression, namely testosterone. And as the punchline, testosterone is far less relevant to aggression than usually assumed. At the other end of the spectrum, the chapter also considers a hormone with cult status for fostering warm, fuzzy prosociality, namely oxytocin. As we'll see, it's not quite as groovy as assumed. Those who are unfamiliar with hormones and endocrinology, please see the primer in Appendix 2. Testosterone's bum rap. Testosterone is secreted by the testes as the final step in the hypothalamic/pituitary/testicular axis. It has effects on cells throughout the body, including neurons, of course. And testosterone is everyone's usual suspect when it comes to the hormonal causes of aggression. Correlation and causality. Why is it that throughout the animal kingdom, and in every human culture, males account for most aggression and violence? Well, what about testosterone and some related hormones, collectively called androgens, a term that, unless otherwise noted, I will use simplistically as synonymous with testosterone? In nearly all species, males have more circulating testosterone than do females, who secrete small amounts of androgens from the adrenal glands. Moreover, male aggression is most prevalent when testosterone levels are highest, adolescence and during mating season in seasonal breeders. Thus, testosterone and aggression are linked. Furthermore, there are particularly high levels of testosterone receptors in the amygdala, in the way station by which it projects to the rest of the brain, the bed nucleus of the stria terminalis, and in its major targets, the hypothalamus, the central gray of the midbrain, and the frontal cortex. But these are merely correlative data. Showing that testosterone causes aggression requires a subtraction plus a replacement experiment. Subtraction? Castrate a male. Do levels of aggression decrease? Yes, including in humans. This shows that something coming from the testes causes aggression. Is it testosterone? Replacement. Give that castrated individual replacement testosterone. Do pre-castration levels of aggression return? Yes, including in humans. Thus, testosterone causes aggression. Time to see how wrong that is. The first hint of a complication comes after castration, when average levels of aggression plummet in every species. But crucially, not to zero. Well, maybe the castration wasn't perfect. You missed some bits of testes. Or maybe enough of the minor adrenal androgens are secreted to maintain the aggression. But no. Even when testosterone and androgens are completely eliminated, some aggression remains. Thus, some male aggression is testosterone independent. This point is driven home by castration of some sexual offenders, a legal procedure in a few states. This is accomplished with chemical castration, administration of drugs that either inhibit testosterone production or block testosterone receptors. Castration decreases sexual urges in the subset of sex offenders with intense, obsessive, and pathological urges. But otherwise, castration doesn't decrease recidivism rates, as stated in one meta-analysis. Hostile rapists and those who commit sex crimes motivated by power or anger are not amenable to treatment with the anti-androgenic drugs. This leads to a hugely informative point. The more experience a male had being aggressive prior to castration, the more aggression continues afterward. In other words, the less his being aggressive in the future requires testosterone, and the more it's a function of social learning. On to the next issue that lessens the primacy of testosterone. What do individual levels of testosterone have to do with aggression? If one person has higher testosterone levels than another, or higher levels this week than last, are they more likely to be aggressive? Initially, the answer seemed to be yes, as studies showed correlation between individual differences in testosterone levels and levels of aggression. In a typical study, higher testosterone levels would be observed in those male prisoners with higher rates of aggression. But being aggressive stimulates testosterone secretion. No wonder more aggressive individuals had higher levels. Such studies couldn't disentangle chickens and eggs. Thus, a better question is whether differences in testosterone levels among individuals predict who will be aggressive. And among birds, fish, mammals, and especially other primates, the answer is generally no. This has been studied extensively in humans, examining a variety of measures of aggression. And the answer is clear. To quote the British endocrinologist John Archer in a definitive 2006 review, there is a weak and inconsistent association between testosterone levels and aggression in human adults, and administration of testosterone to volunteers typically does not increase their aggression. The brain doesn't pay attention to fluctuations of testosterone levels within the normal range. Things differ when levels are made supra-physiological, higher than the body normally generates. This is the world of athletes and bodybuilders abusing high-dose testosterone-like anabolic steroids. In that situation, risk of aggression does increase. Two complications. It's not random who would choose to take these drugs, and abusers are often already predisposed toward aggression. Supraphysiological levels of androgens generate anxiety and paranoia, and increased aggression may be secondary to that. Thus, aggression is typically more about social learning than about testosterone, and differing levels of testosterone generally can't explain why some individuals are more aggressive than others. So what does testosterone actually do to behavior? Subtleties of testosterone effects. When looking at faces expressing strong emotions, we tend to make micro-expressions that mimic them. Testosterone decreases such empathic mimicry. Moreover, testosterone makes people less adept at identifying emotions by looking at people's eyes, and faces of strangers activate the amygdala more than familiar ones and are rated as less trustworthy. Testosterone also increases confidence and optimism while decreasing fear and anxiety. This explains the winner effect in lab animals, where winning a fight increases an animal's willingness to participate in and its success in another such interaction. Part of the increased success probably reflects the fact that winning stimulates testosterone secretion, which increases glucose delivery and metabolism in the animal's muscles and makes his pheromones smell scarier. Moreover, winning increases the number of testosterone receptors in the bed nucleus of the stria terminalis, the way station through which the amygdala communicates with the rest of the brain, increasing its sensitivity to the hormone. Success in everything from athletics to chess to the stock market boosts testosterone levels. Confident and optimistic. Well, endless self-help books urge us to be precisely that. But testosterone makes people overconfident and overly optimistic, with bad consequences. In one study, pairs of subjects could consult each other before making individual choices in a task. Testosterone made subjects more likely to think their opinion was correct and to ignore input from their partner. Testosterone makes people cocky, egocentric, and narcissistic. Testosterone boosts impulsivity and risk-taking, making people do the easier thing when it's the dumbass thing to do. Testosterone does this by decreasing activity in the prefrontal cortex and its functional coupling to the amygdala, and increasing amygdaloid coupling with the thalamus, the source of that shortcut path of sensory information into the amygdala. Thus, more influence by split-second, low-accuracy inputs, and less by the let's-stop-and-think-about-this frontal cortex. Being fearless, overconfident, and delusionally optimistic sure feels good. No surprise, then, that testosterone can be pleasurable. Rats will work, by pressing levers, to be infused with testosterone and show conditioned place preference, returning to a random corner of the cage where infusions occur. I don't know why, but I feel good whenever I stand there. The underlying neurobiology fits perfectly. Dopamine is needed for place preference conditioning to occur, and testosterone increases activity in the ventral tegmentum, the source of those mesolimbic and mesocortical dopamine projections. Moreover, conditioned place preference is induced when testosterone is infused directly into the nucleus accumbens, the ventral tegmentum's main projection target. When a rat wins a fight, the number of testosterone receptors increases in the ventral tegmentum and accumbens, increasing sensitivity to the hormone's feel-good effects. So testosterone does subtle things to behavior. Nonetheless, this doesn't tell us much because everything can be interpreted every which way. Testosterone increases anxiety. You feel threatened and become more reactively aggressive. Testosterone decreases anxiety. You feel cocky and overconfident, become more preemptively aggressive. Testosterone increases risk-taking. Hey, let's gamble and invade. Testosterone increases risk-taking. Hey, let's gamble and make a peace offer. Testosterone makes you feel good. Let's start another fight, since the last one went swell. Testosterone makes you feel good. Let's all hold hands. It's a crucial unifying concept that testosterone's effects are hugely context-dependent. Contingent testosterone effects. This context dependency means that rather than causing X, testosterone amplifies the power of something else to cause X. A classic example comes from a 1977 study of groups of male talapoin monkeys. Testosterone was administered to the middle-ranking male in each group, say, rank number 3 out of 5, increasing their levels of aggression. Does this mean that these guys, stoked on roids, started challenging numbers 1 and 2 in the hierarchy? No. They became aggressive jerks to poor numbers 4 and 5. Testosterone did not create new social patterns of aggression. It exaggerated pre-existing ones. In human studies, testosterone didn't raise baseline activity in the amygdala. It boosted the amygdala's response and heart rate reactivity to angry faces, but not to happy or neutral ones. Similarly, testosterone did not make subjects more selfish and uncooperative in an economic game. It made them more punitive when provoked by being treated poorly, enhancing, vengeful, reactive aggression. The context dependency also occurs on the neurobiological level, in that the hormone shortens the refractory period of neurons in the amygdala and amygdaloid targets in the hypothalamus. Recall that the refractory period comes in neurons after action potentials. This is when the neuron's resting potential is hyperpolarized, i.e. when it's more negatively charged than usual, making the neuron less excitable, producing a period of silence after the action potential. Thus, shorter refractory periods mean a higher rate of action potentials. So is testosterone causing action potentials in these neurons? No. It's causing them to fire at a faster rate if they are stimulated by something else. Similarly, testosterone increases amygdala response to angry faces, but not to other sorts. Thus, if the amygdala is already responding to some realm of social learning, testosterone ups the volume. A key synthesis, the challenge hypothesis. Thus, testosterone's actions are contingent and amplifying, exacerbating pre-existing tendencies toward aggression rather than creating aggression out of thin air. This picture inspired the challenge hypothesis, a wonderfully unifying conceptualization of testosterone's actions. As proposed in 1990 by the superb behavioral endocrinologist John Wingfield of the University of California at Davis and colleagues, the idea is that rising testosterone levels increase aggression only at the time of a challenge, which is precisely how things work. This explains why basal levels of testosterone have little to do with subsequent aggression, and why increases in testosterone due to puberty, sexual stimulation, or the start of mating season don't increase aggression either. But things are different during challenges. Among various primates, testosterone levels rise when a dominance hierarchy first forms or undergoes reorganization. Testosterone rises in humans in both individual and team sports competition, including basketball, wrestling, tennis, rugby, and judo. There's generally a rise in anticipation of the event and a larger one afterward, especially among winners. Remarkably, watching your favorite team win raises testosterone levels, showing that the rise is less about muscle activity than about the psychology of dominance, identification, and self-esteem. Most important, the rise in testosterone after a challenge makes aggression more likely. Think about this. Testosterone levels rise, reaching the brain. If this occurs because someone is challenging you, you head in the direction of aggression. If an identical rise occurs because days are lengthening and mating season is approaching, you decide to fly 1,000 miles to your breeding grounds. And if the same occurs because of puberty, you get stupid and giggly around that girl who plays clarinet in the band. The context dependency is remarkable. Footnote. All these circumstances of testosterone levels rising raises a question. Why not just produce higher levels all the time and save the effort? For one thing, all those androgens are lousy for the cardiovascular system. But more important, they'd get in the way of various pro-social behaviors. For example, among monogamous birds and rodents, if testosterone levels don't drop around the time the female gives birth, the males won't act paternally. And some similar patterns seem to apply to humans. Fathers have lower testosterone levels than age-matched married men without children, and more involved fathers have lower levels than less involved ones. Moreover, evoking nurturing behavior in men lowers testosterone levels, as does the birth of a man's child. And when compared with high testosterone fathers, those with lower average testosterone levels are rated as better parents by their partners and have more activation of their reward-related ventral tegmentum when seeing a picture of their child. The challenge hypothesis has a second part to it. When testosterone rises after a challenge, it doesn't prompt aggression. Instead, it prompts whatever behaviors are needed to maintain status. This changes things enormously. Well, maybe not. Since maintaining status for, say, male primates consists mostly of aggression or threats of it, from slashing your opponent to giving a "you have no idea who you're screwing with" stare. And now for some flabbergastingly important research. What happens if defending your status requires you to be nice? This was explored in a study by Christoph Eisenegger and Ernst Fehr of the University of Zurich. Participants played the ultimatum game, introduced in Chapter 2, where you decide how to split money between you and another player. The other person can accept the split or reject it, in which case neither of you gets anything. Prior research had shown that when someone's offer is rejected, they feel dissed, subordinated, especially if news of that carries into future rounds with other players. In other words, in this scenario, status and reputation rest on being fair. And what happens when subjects were given testosterone beforehand? People made more generous offers. What the hormone makes you do depends on what counts as being studly. This requires some fancy neuroendocrine wiring that is sensitive to social learning. You couldn't ask for a finding more counter to testosterone's reputation. The study contained a slick additional finding that further separated testosterone myth from reality. As per usual, subjects got either testosterone or saline, without knowing which. Subjects who believed it was testosterone, independent of whether it actually was, made less generous offers. In other words, testosterone doesn't necessarily make you behave in a crappy manner, but believing that it does and that you're drowning in the stuff makes you behave in a crappy manner. Additional studies show that testosterone promotes pro-sociality in the right setting. In one, under circumstances where someone's sense of pride rides on honesty, testosterone decreased men's cheating in a game. In another, subjects decided how much of a sum of money they would keep and how much they would publicly contribute to a common pool shared by all the players. Testosterone made most subjects more pro-social. What does this mean? Testosterone makes us more willing to do what it takes to attain and maintain status. And the key point is what it takes. Engineer social circumstances right, and boosting testosterone levels during a challenge would make people compete like crazy to do the most acts of random kindness. In our world riddled with male violence, the problem isn't that testosterone can increase levels of aggression. The problem is the frequency with which we reward aggression. Oxytocin and vasopressin, a marketing dream. If the point of the preceding section is that testosterone has gotten a bum rap, the point of this one is that oxytocin, and the closely related vasopressin, is coasting in a Teflon presidency. According to lore, oxytocin makes organisms less aggressive, more socially attuned, trusting, and empathic. Individuals treated with oxytocin become more faithful partners and more attentive parents. It makes lab rats more charitable and better listeners, makes fruit flies sing like Joan Baez. Naturally, things are more complicated, and oxytocin has an informative dark side. Basics. Oxytocin and vasopressin are chemically similar hormones. The DNA sequences that constitute their genes are similar, and the two genes occur close to each other on the same chromosome. There was a single ancestral gene that, a few hundred million years ago, was accidentally duplicated in the genome, and the DNA sequences in the two copies of the gene drifted independently, evolving into two closely related genes. Stay tuned for more in Chapter 8. This gene duplication occurred as mammals were emerging. Other vertebrates have only the ancestral version, called vasotocin, which is structurally between the two separate mammalian hormones. For 20th century neurobiologists, oxytocin and vasopressin were pretty boring. They were made in hypothalamic neurons that sent axons to the posterior pituitary. There they would be released into circulation, thereby attaining hormone status, and have nothing to do with the brain ever again. Oxytocin stimulated uterine contraction during labor and milk letdown afterward. Vasopressin, aka antidiuretic hormone, regulated water retention in the kidneys. And reflecting their similar structures, each also had mild versions of the other one's effects. End of story. Neurobiologists take notice. things became interesting with the discovery that those hypothalamic neurons that made oxytocin and vasopressin also sent projections throughout the brain, including the dopamine-related ventral tegmentum and nucleus accumbens, hippocampus, amygdala, and frontal cortex, all regions with ample levels of receptors for the hormones. Moreover, oxytocin and vasopressin turned out to be synthesized and secreted elsewhere in the brain. These two boring, classical peripheral hormones affected brain function and behavior. They started being called neuropeptides, neuroactive messengers with a peptide structure, which is a fancy way of saying they are small proteins. And to avoid writing oxytocin and vasopressin endlessly, I will refer to them as neuropeptides. Note, though, that there are other neuropeptides. The initial findings about their behavioral effects made sense. Oxytocin prepares the body of a female mammal for birth and lactation. Logically, oxytocin also facilitates maternal behavior. The brain boosts oxytocin production when a female rat gives birth, thanks to a hypothalamic circuit with markedly different functions in females and males. Moreover, the ventral tegmentum increases its sensitivity to the neuropeptide by increasing levels of oxytocin receptors. Infuse oxytocin into the brain of a virgin rat, and she'll act maternally, retrieving, grooming, and licking pups. Block the actions of oxytocin in a rodent mother, and she'll stop maternal behaviors, including nursing. Oxytocin works in the olfactory system, helping a new mom learn the smell of her offspring. Meanwhile, vasopressin has similar but milder effects. Soon, other species were heard from. Oxytocin lets sheep learn the smell of their offspring and facilitates female monkeys grooming their offspring. Spray oxytocin up a woman's nose, a way to get the neuropeptide past the blood-brain barrier and into the brain, and she'll find babies to look more appealing. Moreover, women with variants of genes that produce higher levels of oxytocin or oxytocin receptors average higher levels of touching their infants and more synchronized gazing with them. So oxytocin is central to female mammals nursing, wanting to nurse their child, and remembering which one is their child. Males then got into the act, as vasopressin plays a role in paternal behavior. A female rodent giving birth increases vasopressin and vasopressin receptor levels throughout the body, including the brain, of the nearby father. Among monkeys, experienced fathers have more dendrites in the frontal cortical neurons containing vasopressin receptors. Moreover, administering vasopressin enhances paternal behaviors. However, an ethological caveat. This occurs only in species where males are paternal, e.g., prairie voles and marmoset monkeys. Footnote. In other words, a familiar theme. Vasopressin doesn't cause paternal behavior, it facilitates it in species that are already predisposed to it. Then, dozens of millions of years ago, some rodent and primate species independently evolved monogamous pair bonding, along with the neuropeptides central to the process. Among marmoset and TT monkeys, which both pair bond, oxytocin strengthens the bond, increasing a monkey's preference for huddling with her partner over huddling with a stranger. Then there was a study that is embarrassingly similar to stereotypical human couples. Among pair-bonding tamarin monkeys, lots of grooming and physical contact predicted high oxytocin levels in female members of a pair. What predicted high levels of oxytocin in males? Lots of sex. Beautiful, pioneering work by Thomas Insull of the National Institute of Mental Health, Larry Young of Emory University, and Sue Carter of the University of Illinois has made a species of vole arguably the most celebrated rodent on Earth. Most voles, e.g. montane voles, are polygamous. In contrast, prairie voles, in a salute to Garrison Keillor, form monogamous mating pairs for life. Naturally, this isn't quite the case. While they are social pair bonders, with their permanent relationships, they're not quite perfect sexual pair bonders, as males might mess around on the side. Nonetheless, prairie voles pair bond more than other voles, prompting Insull, Young, and Carter to figure out why. First finding. Sex releases oxytocin and vasopressin in the nucleus accumbens of female and male voles, respectively. Obvious theory? Prairie voles release more of the stuff during sex than do polygamous voles, causing a more rewarding buzz, encouraging the individuals to stick with their partner. But prairie voles don't release more neuropeptides than montane voles. Instead, prairie voles have more of the pertinent receptors in the nucleus accumbens than do polygamous voles. Moreover, male prairie voles with a variant of the vasopressin receptor gene that produced more receptors in the nucleus accumbens were stronger pair bonders. Then the scientists conducted two tour de force studies. First, they engineered the brains of male mice to express the prairie vole version of the vasopressin receptor in their brains, and they groomed and huddled more with familiar females, but not with strangers. Then the scientists engineered the brains of male montane voles to have more vasopressin receptors in the nucleus accumbens. The males became more socially affiliative with individual females. What about versions of vasopressin receptor genes in other species? When compared with chimps, bonobos have a variant associated with more receptor expression and far more social bonding between females and males, although in contrast to prairie voles, bonobos are anything but monogamous. How about humans? This is tough to study, because you can't measure these neuropeptides in tiny brain regions in humans, and instead have to examine levels in the circulation, a fairly indirect measure. Nevertheless, these neuropeptides appear to play a role in human pair bonding. For starters, circulating oxytocin levels are elevated in couples when they've first hooked up. Furthermore, the higher the levels, the more physical affection, the more behaviors are synchronized, the more long-lasting the relationship, and the happier interviewers rate couples to be. Even more interesting were studies where oxytocin, or a control spray, was administered intranasally. In one fun study, couples had to discuss one of their conflicts, oxytocin up their noses, and they'd be rated as communicating more positively and would secrete less stress hormones. Another study suggests that oxytocin unconsciously strengthens the pair bond. Heterosexual male volunteers, with or without an oxytocin spritz, interacted with an attractive female researcher doing some nonsense task. Among men in stable relationships, oxytocin increased their distance from the woman an average of 4 to 6 inches. Single guys? No effect. Why didn't oxytocin make them stand closer? The researchers indicated that they were already about as close as one could get away with. If the experimenter was male, no effect. Moreover, oxytocin caused males in relationships to spend less time looking at pictures of attractive women. Importantly, oxytocin didn't make men rate these women as less attractive. They were simply less interested. Thus, oxytocin and vasopressin facilitate bonding between parent and child and between couples. Footnote. Note that the entire romantic coupling literature I just discussed solely concerns heterosexual couples. As far as I know, very little has been studied in this realm with gay or lesbian subjects. Now for something truly charming that evolution has cooked up recently. Sometime in the last 50,000 years, i.e., less than 0.1% of the time that oxytocin has existed, the brains of humans and domesticated wolves evolved a new response to oxytocin. When a dog and its owner, but not a stranger, interact, they secrete oxytocin. The more of that time is spent gazing at each other, the bigger the rise. Give dogs oxytocin, and they gaze longer at their humans, which raises the humans' oxytocin levels. So a hormone that evolved for mother-infant bonding plays a role in this bizarre, unprecedented form of bonding between species. In line with its effects on bonding, oxytocin inhibits the central amygdala, suppresses fear and anxiety, and activates the calm, vegetative, parasympathetic nervous system. Moreover, people with an oxytocin receptor gene variant associated with more sensitive parenting also have less of a cardiovascular startle response. In the words of Sue Carter, exposure to oxytocin is a physiological metaphor for safety. Furthermore, oxytocin reduces aggression in rodents, and mice whose oxytocin system was silenced by deleting the gene for oxytocin or its receptor were abnormally aggressive. Other studies show that people rate faces as more trustworthy and are more trusting in economic games when given oxytocin. Oxytocin had no effect when someone thought they were playing with a computer, showing that this was about social behavior. This increased trust was interesting. Normally, if the other player does something duplicitous in the game, subjects are less trusting in subsequent rounds. In contrast, oxytocin-treated investors didn't modify their behavior in this way. Stated scientifically, oxytocin inoculated betrayal aversion among investors. Stated caustically, oxytocin makes people irrational dupes. Stated more angelically, oxytocin makes people turn the other cheek. More pro-social effects of oxytocin emerged. It made people better at detecting happy versus angry, fearful, or neutral faces, or words with positive versus negative social connotations when these were displayed briefly. Moreover, oxytocin made people more charitable. People with a version of the oxytocin receptor gene associated with more sensitive parenting were rated by observers as more pro-social when discussing a time of personal suffering, as well as more sensitive to social approval. And the neuropeptide made people more responsive to social reinforcement, enhancing performance in a task where correct or wrong answers elicited a smile or frown, respectively, while having no effect when right and wrong answers elicited different colored lights. So oxytocin elicits pro-social behavior, and oxytocin is released when we experience pro-social behavior, being trusted in a game, receiving a warm touch, and so on. In other words, a warm and fuzzy positive feedback loop. Obviously, oxytocin and vasopressin are the grooviest hormones in the universe. Pour them into the water supply, and people will be more charitable, trusting, and empathic. We'd be better parents, and would make love, not war. Mostly platonic love, though, since people in relationships would give wide berths to everyone else. Best of all, we'd buy all sorts of useless crap, trusting the promotional banners in stores once oxytocin starts spraying out of the ventilation system. Okay, time to settle down a bit. Pro-sociality versus sociality. Are oxytocin and vasopressin about pro-sociality or social competence? Do these hormones make us see happy faces everywhere or become more interested in gathering accurate social information about faces? The latter isn't necessarily pro-social. After all, accurate information about someone's emotions makes them easier to manipulate. The groovy neuropeptide school supports the idea of ubiquitous pro-sociality. But the neuropeptides also foster social interest and competence. They make people look at eyes longer, increasing accuracy in reading emotions. Moreover, oxytocin enhances activity in the temporoparietal juncture, that region involved in theory of mind, when people do a social recognition task. The hormone increases the accuracy of assessments of other people's thoughts, with a gender twist. Women improve at detecting kinship relations, while men improve at detecting dominance relations. In addition, oxytocin increases accuracy in remembering faces and their emotional expressions, and people with the sensitive parenting oxytocin receptor gene variant are particularly adept at assessing emotions. Similarly, the hormones facilitate rodents' learning of an individual's smell, but not non-social odors. Neuroimaging research shows that these neuropeptides are about social competence as well as prosociality. For example, variants of a gene related to oxytocin signaling are associated with differing degrees of activation of the fusiform face area when looking at faces. Findings like these suggest that abnormalities in these neuropeptides increase the risk of disorders of impaired sociality, namely autism spectrum disorders, ASD. Strikingly, people with ASD show blunted fusiform responses to faces. Remarkably, ASD has been linked to gene variants related to oxytocin and vasopressin, to non-genetic mechanisms for silencing the oxytocin receptor gene and to lower levels of the receptor itself. Moreover, the neuropeptides improve social skills in some individuals with ASD, e.g., enhancing eye contact. Thus, sometimes oxytocin and vasopressin make us more pro-social, but sometimes they make us more avid and accurate social information gatherers. Nonetheless, there is a happy face bias, since accuracy is most enhanced for positive emotions. Time for more complications. Contingent effects of oxytocin and vasopressin. Recall testosterone's contingent effects, e.g., making a monkey more aggressive, but only toward individuals he already dominates. Naturally, these neuropeptides effects are also contingent. One factor already mentioned is gender. Oxytocin enhances different aspects of social competence in women and men. Moreover, oxytocin's calming effects on the amygdala are more consistent in men than in women. Predictably, neurons that make these neuropeptides are regulated by both estrogen and testosterone. As a really interesting contingent effect, oxytocin enhances charitability, but only in people who are already so. This mirrors testosterone's only raising aggression in aggression-prone people. Hormones rarely act outside the context of the individual and his or her environment. Finally, a fascinating study shows cultural contingencies in oxytocin's actions. During stress, Americans seek emotional support, e.g. telling a friend about their problem, more readily than do East Asians. In one study, oxytocin receptor gene variants were identified in American and Korean subjects. Under unstressful circumstances, neither cultural background nor receptor variant affected support-seeking behavior. During stressful periods, support-seeking rose among subjects with a receptor variant associated with enhanced sensitivity to social feedback and approval, but only among the Americans, including Korean Americans. What does oxytocin do to support-seeking behavior? It depends on whether you're stressed, and on the genetic variant of your oxytocin receptor, and on your culture. More to come in chapters 8 and 9. And the dark side of these neuropeptides. As we saw, oxytocin and vasopressin decreases aggression in rodent females. Except for aggression in defense of one's pups, which the neuropeptide increases via effects in the central amygdala, with its involvement in instinctual fear. This readily fits with these neuropeptides enhancing maternalism, including snarling, don't get one step closer maternalism. Similarly, vasopressin enhances aggression in paternal prairie vole males. This finding comes with a familiar additional contingency. The more aggressive the male prairie vole, the less that aggression decreases after blocking of his vasopressin system. Just as in the case of testosterone, with increased experience, aggression is maintained by social learning rather than by a hormone/neuropeptide. Moreover, vasopressin increases aggression most in male rodents who are already aggressive, yet another biological effect depending on individual and social context. And now to really upend our view of these feel-good neuropeptides. For starters, back to oxytocin enhancing trust and cooperation in an economic game. But not if the other player is anonymous and in a different room. When playing against strangers, oxytocin decreases cooperation, enhances envy when luck is bad, and enhances gloating when it's good. Finally, beautiful studies by Karsten de Drew of the University of Amsterdam showed just how unwarm and unfuzzy oxytocin can be. In the first, male subjects formed two teams. Each subject chose how much of his money to put into a pot shared with teammates. As usual, oxytocin increased such generosity. Then participants played the prisoner's dilemma with someone from the other team. Footnote. In the prisoner's dilemma, each of the two players must decide whether to cooperate. If they both cooperate, they each get, say, 2 units of reward. If they both backstab, they each get 1 unit. If one cooperates and the other backstabs, the cheater gets 3 units and the stooge gets none. When financial stakes were high, making subjects more motivated, oxytocin made them more likely to preemptively stab the other player in the back. Thus, oxytocin makes you more pro-social to people like you, i.e. your teammates, but spontaneously lousy to others who are a threat. As emphasized by DeDrew, perhaps oxytocin evolved to enhance social competence to make us better at identifying who is an us. In DeDrew's second study, Dutch student subjects took the implicit association test of unconscious bias, and oxytocin exaggerated biases against 2 outgroups, namely Middle Easterners and Germans. Then came the study's truly revealing second part. Subjects had to decide whether it was okay to kill one person in order to save 5. In the scenario, the potential sacrificial lamb's name was either stereotypically Dutch, Dirk or Peter, German, Markus or Helmut, or Middle Eastern, Ahmed or Yusuf. The 5 people in danger were unnamed. Remarkably, oxytocin made subjects less likely to sacrifice good old Dirk or Peter rather than